Mark and Dan, thanks very much for finding time to talk about the latest project from Sound and Fury. After the immense success of Kursk, which began its life at the Young Vic and has since wowed audiences not only in the UK but further afield, everyone's interested to know what Going Dark is going to present us with. And I know it has had a trial already, is that right? But maybe you could kind of, as it were, give us a beginner's guide to the piece, why it was the next thing on the list, and what you've done.
Mm-hmm. Well, we wanted to, having produced something very complex in Kursk in a way, but very emotive, we were keen once more to find a very strong emotional journey for the audience. But working on a one-man show, we kind of wanted to hunker down in a way and do something that was beautifully simple and elegant, but using all the technological resources that we've learned about and brought on board, mm-hmm. and the fluency that's given us in storytelling. And we're working with actor John Mackay on the story of a man who goes blind. And that journey into blindness is also an exploration, because he's an astronomer, as it were, of what it means to lose a sense, but how the brain deals with that incoming information, being analogous in some way to the way that the human race through history has tried to interpret the information coming in from the cosmos, and how we've been tripped up by certain illusions and discoveries. And so it's a parallel journey of science's understanding of the cosmos with our understanding of the way that brains create the world we see around us.
So it sounds as though, so it's coming from one very particular interesting story. I suppose my assumption had been, science at the moment, people can't get enough of that, and astronomy particularly. So you weren't looking out, as it were, into the void or into the universe as a starting point. It was actually more close to home, or more close to humanity.
It's kind of interesting what the starting point for this play was. It goes back, it could go back 10 or 15 years to when Tom, who isn't with us today, was doing a kind of scratch show for his theatre school training at the Bristol Old Vic, and had always been interested in astronomy and came up with this idea of a kind of planetarium presenter. That was one sort of elemental beginning of how to explore the cosmos in a theatrical setting, and these planetaria are scattered across the planet, and they, have a kind of civic role as a kind of place of learning and a place of entertainment, and there seemed to be a nice and interesting resonance between that and a theatre. So that was one sort of impulse. We were talking earlier about perceptual experience and our meeting with Professor Richard Gregory, who saw one of our early works staged in total darkness, and his field being what visual perception is and how it works, had been so excited by the visual experience of seeing a play in total darkness that sort of excited us about the experience of blindness and what that is like, and how one could theatrically explore that. So these were the sort of two early routes. Professor Richard Gregory put us onto a book called Touching the Rock by John Hull, which is about a man who progressively loses his sight. It's an autobiography. And there just seemed to be this, it kind of didn't stare us in the face, but there's a resonance between one person's world slowly closing down and the connection with your changing world and life between what is going out way beyond in a void that you can never see. And as with many sort of subjects, the more you explore that and the more you look at that, the more, the strange and interesting coincidences or facts that emerge. One of which is, that as the universe is expanding, the light can't reach us. It can't. The rate at which the universe is expanding is, out of step with the speed of light. And that, in effect, to put in simple terms, the universe itself is kind of going blind, is going dark. And this sort of provides a wonderful sort of epic metaphor for this microcosmic story of a man whose world is closing down, and how connected he is to himself, to his child, to his job, and to the universe. And it allows us to move across some very interesting ideas about how the brain works, how visual perception informs us, how much more than visual perception you need to understand anything or everything, and that we rely so much on sight, we rely so much on that for quite rightly, but that there are other methods and there are other ways of understanding that it's worth questioning, exploring and being curious about.
I mean, you talk about that interest in perception and the way the brain, you know, as it were, kind of processes some of this information. Ether Frolics was one of the shows in which I suppose that was quite a manifest inquiry. You were looking at how someone reacted or how the brain reacted to being kind of shut down under anaesthetic. And I wondered in terms of that show and this show, there was an interest there from an audience's point of view in how early in the process of creating a show you thought about design. I mean, is it the case that with this show particularly, the design doesn't come at some point down the line, it comes on day one with the ideas, mm-hmm. I suppose.
Well, that's a leading question with this, because we in fact were sort of in the position of almost having to put the coach before the horses, given that we, as people who like to develop our shows, were entered for the Limbury competition, which, well, I say we were entered, we became judges of that, and were very lucky enough to select as our design partner, Alice Valashek, whose design for the show won the Limbury Prize in the end. But that came at a very early stage in our development. So we were having to work with him, trying to fill him in on sort of details that he would want, such as story and location and setting and so forth, when we hadn't even really properly fleshed out the story that we were going to tell. So that was actually a key point for us in dealing with that. But Alice dealt with it brilliantly. His design has been streamlined and refined as the piece since the competition has become more developed and evolved, and we're now at the stage of course knowing word for word what's being said from scene to scene.
So I mean, crudely,
it's kind of, I mean, just to touch on that, it's a process of discovery. I mean, as we're not working with a script delivered on day one or the one that we've taken out of a library. We've got ideas and we've got things that we want to explore within those ideas narratively. So you could have as easily have asked, you know, does it start with a script? Mm. You know, the research for the script began years ago in a very small and curious way. And it's built up over time, you know, and then amongst ourselves, and then in dialogue with the writer, Hattie Naylor, who we work very close with, I mean, collaboratively. I mean, we sort of forged the play, as it were, together with her into a draft. There have been successive drafts, even through the process of, obviously through rehearsal, and even through the process of performance. I mean, this is the nature of where devised theatre meets scripted theatre. You're going to arrive at a piece in performance, and you want to refine it. And the design element, it's a really interesting question, because we have an aesthetic that is built, that builds sound very closely into it. We have an aesthetic as well that was born out of sense deprivation, sight, total darkness. Those were elements that we knew we were going to use in this piece, particularly in this piece, that we would want to use total darkness as a part of the palette. And as Dan said, Alesh produced designs that were based upon a period of our research, but that period of research didn't stop at his presentation of a design. It carries on being refined. That's what's exciting about working in theatre, is you can be responsive. I mean, it's complicated, but it has its moments of being difficult to deliver, and it has the parameters and the boundaries of cost and so on. But it's a wonderfully elastic process to work in if you can keep a lot of those options open for as long as possible.
Sometimes think designers, some designers produce almost a system rather than a set, mm-hmm. rather than a whole load of settings for you. They actually produce a system which can deliver that and remain flexible. And that's exactly what Alice has done. I mean, it didn't happen straight away, but he's arrived at this incredibly elegant and beautiful way of producing all the worlds we need to visit, both cosmic and sort of internalized. And you know, it is, as Mark says, returning to some of our favorite techniques in terms of total darkness and immersive sound.
And one of the things that I'd like to add to that is we always felt that projection, using video projection for this piece, would be fun. And that's a really good impulse. It would be fun to use video projection in a fresh way. And one thing that we explored in Ether Frolics with the lighting designer that we worked with then, Simon Mesa Wright and David Rosenberg, well, the whole team actually, Lizzie Clacken and Hannah Ringham, was how to project images in total darkness, which sounds massively counterintuitive, but was great because, you know, on a black screen in total darkness, projecting line drawings of shapes like pyramids or cubes that suddenly took on a whole different perceptual meaning to the audience. They were no longer 2D images on a flat screen. They appeared to spin in space. And that was quite an interesting place for us to leave that production and start begin with in Going Dark is how could we use projections in a fresh way? And we can't expect, nor would we, a designer to do all of that for us, although, you know, Alesh provided lots of wonderful provocations which we picked up and ran with. But, you know, we worked with Dick Straker from Mesmer on doing some of the projection work for this piece. And that's a whole other dimension. I mean, if that's, you know, almost part of the vocabulary of the piece, it's a whole other dimension of theatre work. It's something that's being talked about a bit at the moment about, is projection a facile add-on? Of course it isn't. It's another instrument. It's another tool.
Anything can be a facile add-on if you want it to be.
What can one say in terms of the set? I mean, is it that that there's a kind of interest in how the planetarium itself transports a spectator? Is this a mini planetarium of some form, with knobs on, as it were?
I think the audience will rapidly discover that we do sort of have the framework of a planetarium as our starting point. But, you know, there's always this challenge with a one-man show. You know, what are you going to do with one man? Is his relationship with the audience, or one woman for them? Is their relationship going to be with the audience? Or are you going to take the plunge and have other characters either imagined, embodied in some way? And we use sound to deal with that as well. So there's there's a quality, I think, to the piece, which does actually deal with the subjective experience of what it is like to be hearing somebody else's voice. And so we've put the audience inside a very dark space, completely blacked out, that can become a planetarium, but it can become the inside of this man's house, but it can also become the inside of his head. And I think it's just brilliantly flexible what Alice has done in that respect.
I mean, one of the key elements, I think, that we learned in early research and development that we did at the Roundhouse was how to make a one-man show fresh. And we were looking at, obviously, using sound and having interlocutors who weren't just voiceovers, but finding a dynamism in that. And this man has a relationship with his child. Obviously, his child is 6 years old in the play. And we found a way of being able to bring that character into the room with the sound design that Dan has done. That makes it feel like you are spatially inhabiting the same space as the actor. So 1 minute a planetarium, the next inside his head, at home, with his family, with his small family, with his child, as he's talking to him, and you kind of witness this conversation. And it was a really exciting process because the way that we went about that was, okay, so this very domestic setting of a father shaving while talking to his son, and they might talk about how the world came into existence. So how are we going to script that? Well, you don't want to write it all down. We talked to a six-year-old, Tom's son, Jack, and let him freeform, discuss, talk to us in the most relaxed and easy way.
Ask your daddy some questions about... He refused to do that. He said, do you mind if I do some more statements? And he proceeded to expound his six-year-old, incredibly comprehensive, thanks to, I'm sure, Tom and Anna's brilliant educative skills, his extraordinary model of the universe and the cosmos and how it was organised. And at first there was this sort of frustration of, please, Jack, come on, ask some questions. We need this sort of, you know, question-response thing with your stage dad, which at one stage we were even thinking might be Tom. Mm-hmm. And he didn't. But what we ended up with was the most delightful and unscriptable, I mean, you know, you couldn't have written it, sort of set of ideas, which are both scientifically unnervingly on the button, but also are just a fantastically fresh way of seeing these things. And it's been a gift to hear, you know, to relearn the excitement of these discoveries through, you know, the voice of a six-year-old.
So it's a bit like he was allowed to riff.
Yes.
he was allowed to riff on the subject, and then we took that recording and allowed the actor, or in the research and development, we gave ourselves the permission to riff with that. So it was kind of like a kind of three-stage improvisation, firstly with just the freeform expostulation from this six-year-old, then cutting it up and creating a dialogue out of that. And that's was a very liberating experience, and a kind of, you know, I hope it's sort of, I think it is, a fresh approach to peopling a one-man show and making it feel like you've entered this person's world, and that it's just, and that it isn't all theatrical devices or, you know, telephone conversations or, you know, the kind of which we do have, of course. I mean, you can't escape it in a way, but
yes. I mean, going to say, you know, I suppose there's an easy connection between, I suppose, childlike wonder and innocent wonder, actually, at the universe, and I suppose just generally what we feel when we see these huge spaces, these huge constellations that we can't reach and never know about fully. I mean, did you go to a lot of, how much scientific research have you done for this? I mean, did you go to a lot of planetariums for a start? Did you, what have you discovered, I suppose, that's gone into this, maybe not been seen on stage before?
Yeah, we've done quite a lot of that sort of thing. I mean, we visited planetaria and done a lot of reading. And I should say, on Tom's behalf, he had an artist in residence period at Birmingham University in the astrophysics department, where he had brilliant access to people who were asking some of these massive cosmological questions. And we talked to a lot of people. I mean, you might want to add to what other research we did.
Right? Yeah, I mean, astronomy has been a sort of long-term interest in many ways, and Tom's shown that. And my dad was a Horizon producer at the BBC when I was in Single Figures, and so I was correcting my teacher at the age of seven about solar winds and getting detention for doing so. There's no such thing as wind in space. There's no air. Don't be silly. And you know, I think science has been, it's been the science of astronomy and cosmology is something we've been desperate to make a piece about. So it's not just the immediate research we've done about the piece. It's the sort of long-term legacy of also feeling it. It's just been a really intrinsic part of.
I mean, it's also, I mean, I was very fascinated about what sight is and what it does. And we are very fortunate to have the backing of the Wellcome Foundation in funding the piece, who have funded a lot of our work in the past, actually. This is the third piece they funded for us. And they put us, with the help of Fuel, our producers, we've uncovered a brilliant resource in Dr. Dominic Fitch, who's an expert in visual perception. And introduce us to the idea of what happens with the onset of blindness and a condition called Charles-Bonnet syndrome, which is hallucination. As you go blind, you hallucinate more, and you hallucinate extremely. And this is a very kind of almost taboo subject. I mean, people don't know a lot about it, but this, the what goes on between eye and brain is a very, very interesting area. And what goes on when eye shuts down, and what brain does to try to see without the optical instrument, is equally, you know, mysterious and unusual. And that provoked a lot of interesting discussion and reading with Dominic Fitch, but also follow-up work. And it was Professor Richard Gregory, who was to have been our consultant, sadly he died, on this project, has written extensively about this, and they were really important source materials for us. Mm. A book called Eye and Brain was his sort of magnum opus, as it were, and that was a real watchword.
And well, just quickly, I mean, a lot of this is analysed in terms of cognitive science, and and the research that Dominic Fitch is doing is particularly interesting because it deals with the actual mechanisms of sight in the brain. And for example, we went along on one memorable occasion to one of his labs where he put on these goggles where we were fed white, bright, flashing light, which when it flashes at a certain frequency, it strobes at a certain frequency, it actually generates very, very strongly coloured patterns that shift and move, incredible iridescent colours. And this is all triggered by white light flashing very fast. And what it's doing is actually starting to reveal the machine, if you will, inside our heads. That sounds quite inhuman, but I think to be honest about the sort of mechanics of our biology is in a way to embrace the humanity of what we are without compromising it, because it sort of makes you all the more humble at how miraculous what the brain does manage to do with what appears to be the real world around us. It's sort of almost, I mean, at the end of the day, we sort of, you know, as if living in a dream, we want to make people possibly just gently question the certainty of what is around us. That might be the sort of philosophical undercurrent which underlines the whole piece.
Thank you both very much.